change. One of these days.
Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff, for this program that looks into the economic dimensions of our lives, our jobs, our incomes, our debts, our hopes for the economic well-being of our children. We have changed our format a little bit. We're going to jump right into the economic updates. Then I'm going to respond to questions sent in by all of you. And again, I want to thank you and welcome your communications to us through our two websites, and I'll talk more about that at the break and at the end of our program. And in the second half, we will have a guest interview today, which I am sure you'll find remarkably interesting in terms of broadening the range of what we discuss here. Okay, so let's turn to updates for this late November session. First, I want to bring to everyone's attention the remarkable events going on over the last month and continuing in Italy. A few days ago, the two largest union federations in Italy had another huge pattern of strikes across the country and demonstrations, hot off the enormously successful mass strikes at the end of October. Here were again another set. And they're interesting not only because of the hundreds of thousands of people across Italy who went into the streets waving the red flags of their unions in this issue. It's not just that. It's what it's about and what it means. The two important issues that mobilized all these people are, first, the movement of the Italian government right now, governed by a center-left political coalition, rather like the Democratic Party in the United States, and it's called the Democratic Party in Italy as well, a movement by that government to relax labor laws by making it easier for employers to fire workers with or without cause. This is something the unions deal with all the time. It is a sacrosanct issue for them, one that they care about a great, great deal, and they're not about to let that happen. And the other thing is the austerity program of the Renzi government, Renzi the chief leader of the current government. They want to cut government programs, and of course the major beneficiaries of the programs they want to cut are working people. So against those cuts and against the change in the labor law, not only have they been building on their strikes, but they've taken the next step. On December 12th, they have called for a general strike across all of Italy. They're going to call upon the working people of Italy, those they can reach, who number in the millions, that's what everybody expects, will be out, not working, on the 12th of December, and I think it's something that we will pay attention to. I also want to point out that traditionally there's an alliance between the trade union movement and the left of center political forces, such as the Democratic Party and the Renzi government in power now. What we're seeing is a split in that relationship. It's a recognition by the unions in Italy that voting for the center-left parties, like the Democratic Party, and again, note the similarity to other countries' situations, where likewise trade unions work with the lesser of two evils, the center-left party as against the center-right parties in their oscillations. Here in Italy, a break has happened, and I think it's going to have reverberations all over the world. The unions responsible to their members see that they have to work against their erstwhile ally because their erstwhile ally, the Democratic center-left forces, aren't their ally in practice anymore. My next update has to do with a kind of cautionary tale, maybe even a moral tale, you might say, about rich and poor. It has to do with the Metropolitan Opera in New York City. This is the number one opera house in the entire United States. It occupies a beautiful building in the center of Lincoln Center, which is the name of the center in New York City for much of its musical culture, the Philharmonic Orchestra, theater, a remarkable center, been there for quite a while. and in the middle, the Metropolitan Opera. The Metropolitan Opera is interesting economically, however, for an entirely different reason. Last year, it ran a deficit. It had raised ticket prices. I'll give you an example of forthcoming Aida opera performance. The cheapest ticket is over $100, and the tickets run up to $350 per seat. They raised the ticket prices, hoping to make more money. Turned out they got fewer people who went to the opera because they couldn't afford it. These are people who aren't deep pockets, but love the opera, and there are plenty of those. In any case, they ran a deficit, $3 million. And so they got concessions from the musicians, about 5%. The musicians gave back. That is, notice, please, it's not that they didn't get their raises. They're starting to demand in our economy now wage cuts. And this year, it looks like the deficit might go to $10 million. And so they've asked the lead singers to take cuts of about 7%. Okay, I looked into this. This icon of American culture, this number one opera house in the United States. Well, as I said, it's part of Lincoln Center. And we're talking about hundreds of musicians and others involved having to take wage cuts because they had a $3 million deficit. That's $3 million for the entire year's budget. On the board of Lincoln Center, which is the parent of all of these cultural events like the Metropolitan Opera, on the board of the Lincoln Center, I noticed the name David Koch, K-O-C-H, or sometimes called David Koch, part of the famous or infamous Koch brothers. So I looked him up, and I found that Forbes magazine, which keeps a record of these things, has David Koch listed as the 24th richest man in the United States. He's on the board of the Lincoln Center, which is the host, the home of the Metropolitan Opera. According to Forbes magazine, he has a personal wealth of $42.7 billion, that's with a B, dollars. So I did a little math. I made the assumption that he can invest his $42.7 billion of wealth at about 5%. The truth is he can probably do well better than that. Most people in that category do. But let's be conservative. Let's say he only makes 5% on his wealth. Well, that works out to $6 million a day. $365 a year. Every day, David Koch makes $6 million if he's earning 5%. You can see why he doesn't bother to buy lottery tickets, because he wins the lottery every day without buying a ticket. But here's my point. He would have had to use one morning's income would have gotten him $3 million, because he gets $6 million a day. And with the one morning's income, he could have given it to the Metropolitan Opera, and they could have had a wonderful season. They wouldn't have had to squeeze the income of their musicians and the others who work there. They wouldn't have had to appeal to opera singers to give 7% of their income back. But he didn't, did he? No, he didn't. He didn't do it. That's why they ran the $3 million deficit. Mr. Koch and folks like him, therefore, are not, in fact, simply caring about their wealth. They want to keep their wealth growing, and if that means a hobbling of the number one cultural activity in the Lincoln Center in many ways, certainly the number one opera house in America, if they could keep it going with a trivial amount of money for them, they won't do it. They want to be on the board of the cultural event, but they also want to stick it to the musicians, to stick it to the workers there, and to charge more to the people who pay tickets. They're in the mentality that goes with a society that allows that kind of wealth in the first place. They have to make it moral that they're so wealthy, and moral that they are cutting back on the people whose whole life and artistic situation they could save with one morning's income. Next update. Similar kind of story about something very wrong in our society in terms of economics. I want to talk to you about a baseball team, in particular the Miami Marlins in Miami, Florida. Why? Well, this last week, it emerged that they've signed the most lucrative contract ever for a baseball player. Name of the player, Giancarlo Stanton. He just got a 13-year contract that will pay him $325 million. Let me break that down so we all understand. He's going to get $25 million per year for the 13 years. By the way, this last year, 2014, his pay was $6.5 million. So you can see he is moving up in the stratosphere. And how does that work out? That works out to $154,000 per game that he will play. Let me do that again. He will play a game. Some of you will go see it. You'll sit there for 2 hours. You will have paid the tickets, and he will have earned $154,000 for that activity. I could stop there and ask what kind of a society allocates its money that way. And this is in no way disrespectful to the obvious talent that Giancarlo Stanton has. He has extraordinary talent, and he deserves respect. Whether he deserves this kind of money compared to what that money could do for thousands of other people is the question I want you to ask. But even that wouldn't have made me choose this topic for this update. No, I did a little research, and here's what I discovered. The stadium that the Miami Marlins have, that Mr. Stanton will play in, the stadium is very expensive. And in the end, it will cost about $3 billion when you add up the cost of constructing it and the cost of all the loans that had to be taken out to pay for the construction of it. All of that money has to be paid back over quite a few years with interest. But here's the punchline, folks. Huge portion of that debt isn't the debt of the Miami Marlins, who collect the money from the tickets. It isn't going to be paid by the Miami Marlins, who get the fat contracts with TV when they broadcast those games. No. The people of Miami and the people of Dade County, the county in Florida where Miami is located, they are on the hook because of political deals made between the Miami Marlins and the local politicians. So the taxes of the Miami residents and the Dade County residents will, for the next many years, be going into the coffers of the Miami Marlins. Did the public that is paying for that stadium have a say in how much is to be paid to the baseball players? How much of this? Not a word. Do they have a say in the profits earned by this company that they ought to participate in since they're funding the bill? Not at all. It's the peculiar way in America that we socialize the costs. We spread them out. But we don't socialize the benefits. We don't socialize the money being raked in. That's private enterprise, don't you know, with social costs borne by the public. Last quick update for today is a story of Argentina. Argentina has been in the news over the last year because it does not want to pay a portion of its accumulated debts. This is something that it started a decade or more ago when it had a very hard economic time, and like people who have economic difficulties or companies who do, countries sometimes tell their creditors, look, we can't pay, and therefore we're going to have to renegotiate the deal. All lenders know about this because it happens all the time. Argentina is not the first. Argentina will not be the last. This is kind of normal business. Of course, the lenders to Argentina yell and scream they want to be paid. Of course they do. Lenders always do, and the borrower says, we'd love to pay you the way we have for so many years, but we can't now, so let's sit down like adults and work this out. Well, Argentina and the United States are not working that out real well. And so Argentina has simply said, well, we're not going to pay. And the United States has threatened with private and public statements that this is going to make Argentina have economic difficulties. Nobody will ever lend them again. Well, guess what? Turns out someone did. Over the last few weeks, the People's Republic of China has arranged an $11 billion loan to whom? To Argentina, which will enable Argentina's economic development to grow. It will build closer relationships between Argentina and China. It will allow Argentina to thumb its nose at the pressures from the United States. And here's the irony. Where does China get the money to help Argentina in its struggles with the United States over its debts? The answer is American capitalism. American capitalism is pouring money into the People's Republic of China. It's paying for all the goods that are shipped from China here, the clothing, the appliances, and all the rest. All that money flowing into China, the Chinese don't need it to buy goods from America because we don't export all that much, nothing like what we import. So the money accumulates in China, and they found an interesting use for it. But the money begins because American businesses want to buy that Chinese material, and it ends up costing the United States. That's how capitalism works. I want to turn now, in the time that we have, to some of your questions. First question. You mentioned UNICEF in your previous week's discussions, and we are interested in learning more than you discussed about that. Fair enough. We'd like you to talk about the situation of children in the United States. And can you give us some more? I am. I think that's a very good question, and it allows me to say some things about the UNICEF report that I indeed did not have time for last time, and also to give you some other information. But before I do, I want to give you the punchline. What I'm about to tell you about the condition of children in the United States is a piece of evidence about something we talk about on this program frequently, namely, that there is no recovery. Or to be more precise, that the so-called recovery in the United States from the great crisis that descended on all of us in 2008 only affects the richest 4 or 5%, if that, and the big corporations. Everybody else has been bypassed by this recovery, and nothing shows it more than what I'm about to tell you. First, the UNICEF report. The UNICEF report says that the condition of children under the impact of the 2008 recession has been heavy. They looked at the 41 most affluent, richest countries in the world, which of course includes the United States. And they found that if you look at a number of measures, the United States ranks 27 out of 41, where one is the best, the least damage to children, and 41 is the worst. The United States comes in at 27. What does that mean? Well, let's begin. Over the last period, since the crisis began in 2008, there's been a 2% increase in the number of children living in poverty in the United States. Let me make that real clear, 2%. That's 1.7 million more children in the United States than before this crisis hit. Wow. But it's actually worse than that. 31%, some measures 32%, of children in poverty. One in three American children is in poverty. And it's gotten worse during this recession. It hasn't gotten better, and we haven't recovered in all compared to what we were before the recession hit. Quite the contrary. And I began to wonder, what are some of the reasons? And I thought, here's something that I could bring to your attention. Every country in Europe, almost every country in Europe, provides some kind of subsidized child care, some sort of paid maternity leave, and some sort of direct cash transfer to parents to help pay for the cost of raising children. The United States does none of that. Wow. Is it just the advanced countries of Europe? No. I discovered, just in beginning to look, and the UNICEF report makes it clear, that in Pakistan, a very poor country, 12 weeks of paid maternity leave is the law. In Brazil, another country that is much poorer than most countries of Western Europe and the United States, Brazil's government gives mothers monthly cash benefits to help raise their children. The United States does none of this. And if you want to understand the condition of children, and if you want to understand the impact of the recession, you will see that when children are concerned, recovery is not the word you want. Well-being is not the word you want. Horror at the enormous wealth like that of David Koch and folks like that, contrasted with the fact we have almost 2 million more children living in poverty as a result of this recession than we had in 2007 before it hit. But I did some more research, and I found a very interesting report released in November of 2014, so it's very up to date, called America's Youngest Outcasts, a report card on child homelessness, produced by the American Institutes for Research. And by the way, if you're interested, just go on the web to homelesschildrenamerica.org, homelesschildrenamerica.org, and you can get their report. But here are just two highlights that drive the same point home. During 2013, the last year for which the research could get the data, the number of children who experienced homelessness in the United States was 2,483,000 children. That represents one in every 30 children in the United States experienced homelessness during the year. Wow. During 2013, homelessness among children increased in 31 out of the 50 states and in the District of Columbia. Children are homeless in every city, county, and state of the United States. During 2013, total homelessness of children increased by 8% in that 1 year alone. What recovery? It increased by 10% or more in 13 of the 50 states and the District of Columbia. Wow, what recovery are we talking about? There is no recovery from the mass of the people. And above all, there is no recovery for the children. And that speaks volumes about the economic well-being, so-called, that we hear about. Here's another question, very good one, and I wish I had more time to answer it. The question is this: how is there ever going to be a political party that isn't compromised, this question says, that isn't basically subservient to the status quo economically, that basically says there's nothing to be changed in the basic way we organize business, private shareholders select a board of directors that makes all the decisions, and the mass of people live with it, accept it, even though they have no power over it? What happened to our political system that nobody opposes this? Nobody advocates change, and nobody therefore can vote to express their feeling, for example, that we can do better than an economic system that has delivered us no recovery, as I just made clear, have plunged us into this crisis over the last 6 years, produces the inequality that the story about the Metropolitan Opera illustrates so well, and so on. I think the answer, the response I can give, is the following. Over time, the two political parties in the United States and their equivalents in many other countries became dependent on money. That was the way that the people who ran the big corporations and the rich, that was how they made politics subservient to them. You don't directly go in and do that. You make politics become a costly affair, and then it turns out, surprise, surprise, that those who have the most money are the ones who confront it, who can contribute it, who can donate it to the party, to the politician, to the campaign of their choice. And so we end up with political parties that have to compete for the money. And the way you compete for money from rich people and from big businesses is for sure never questioning the money that big businesses have, the wealth that the wealthy have accumulated, and so on. So how could we ever have a political party that disagreed, that offered a real alternative, that made a criticism that people could vote for or against according to their preferences? You'd have to develop a political party that could raise the resources it needed to take its message to the mass of people, but not be dependent on corporations and wealthy people to provide the money. How is that to be done? And here's the sketch of an answer. Suppose we develop in the United States, and that's actually beginning to happen, a group of businesses that are owned and operated by the workers collectively. Democratic enterprises, you might call them. Worker co-ops, in which all the decisions are not made by a tiny board of directors selected by the major shareholders. Instead, the workers together decide the kinds of issues, what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and so on, that are normally in capitalism decided by the board of directors. And now suppose that capitalist business see these new kinds of democratic businesses as a bit of danger to them, because most working people, if given a choice, would rather buy something made that way by workers in a community. Most people would rather work in such a workplace than a top-down hierarchical capitalist enterprises where they have to do what they're told with no power over the decisions that affect their lives. And so we might begin to see that enterprises that are democratic need a political party to protect them from the pressures of the old capitalist organization and its parties. So you could begin to develop a relationship between newly emerging cooperative workplaces and a political party that expresses this new way of doing things and is critical of the old capitalist ways. And then you could begin to have real political choice. The party would be based in worker co-ops, and the worker co-ops would support the party that in turn helps them, creates the space legally, creates the space for government help to co-ops the way governments have helped capitalist enterprises, and so on. That's the way a new political party might emerge. As often I say, I wish I had more time. Your questions are invaluable. They are an important part of this program, not just when I answer you specifically, but in shaping all that we do. So please use our two websites, rdwolf2fs.com and democracyatwork.info. Those websites not only have all of our programs, every one of these programs is archived there, but it's a way for you to communicate to us your questions, your thoughts, your comments. And that way, we keep back and forth, which helps make this program good. We're going to take our mid-program break right now. I'll be back in a very, very short time with my guest for the interview portion of today's program. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Oh, where have you been, my blue-eyed son? And where have you been, my darling young one? I stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked and I've crawled on 6 crooked highways. I stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. And it's hard.
Welcome back, friends. This is Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff, and it gives me enormous pleasure to bring onto the program a guest. We've had her here before, but you have let me know you'd like to see us continue the kinds of discussions and exchanges we've had in the past. Her name is Dr. Harriet Fraud. She's a mental health counselor, a hypnotherapist in New York City, where she practices and has practiced for years. She also writes articles regularly for the following publications: truthout.org, the same outfit that I write for, Rethinking Marxism, an important academic journal over the last 30 years, Tikkun magazine, and the Psychohistory Journal. Her next article, to be forthcoming shortly, is a piece analyzing the sex work industry that will appear shortly on the internet magazine Logos, L-O-G-O-S. And you can also find out more about her by going to her website, Harriet Fraud, spelled F-R-A-A-D, harrietfraud.com. Welcome, Harriet. Glad to have you again.
Glad to be here.
Okay, let's jump right into what it is we want to do today, and that has to do with counting properly in economics. And here's what I mean. Economists do count when it comes to economic problems, for example, unemployment. They count how many people are unemployed, how many wages, therefore, they don't get, how much output is not produced when people are sitting idle, how much raw materials and machines wear out and are wasted because we're not using them. And yet, your profession, psychology, teaches us something that economists usually ignore, namely all of the complicated other consequences on people's feelings, on people's relationships, on people's sense of themselves. All of those things have enormous effects on the quality of life and have enormous economic costs associated with them, but they're simply not counted. And so I wanted to ask you to help us. So let's begin. Can you tell us something about the psychological consequences that you've discovered in your practice, in your studies, the consequences of employment, of unemployment, excuse me, as a key economic problem? And let's start, what are the consequences, psychologically speaking, for people who are themselves unemployed?
Well, the consequences differ, of course, with each individual, but they also differ across groups. So what I'd like to do is respond to that question by responding to it as it affects different groups.
Fine.
And let's start with young single people, because they have the highest unemployment rate, even with the kind of jerry-rigged formal figures, 14% unemployment rate for young people, whereas there is only about six, five-something percent rate for people above 30. Now, for young men and women, it really means that they can't afford to exist on their own if they're unemployed. For those lucky enough to afford to have a family they can live with or who could help them financially, they have that option. Those more fortunate people still have to borrow money but go back to school. The last huge movement to go back to school in the United States was during the last Great Depression of the 1930s. It's now a similar pattern for young people today. However, it's different now than it was in the 1930s. When one gets a degree, one doesn't necessarily have a job. There's precarity that faces people, and people are terrified. there's an article in the Chronicle of Higher Education that says the new PhD comes with food stamps, because one of the big increases in the food stamp population are people with master's degrees and PhDs. Unemployment for young men really means that a future with a partner, or marriage if that's up, but a future is out of the question. The attractiveness of an unemployed man, I've heard over and over again in my practice, men saying, what am I going to put on OkCupid? Unemployed for 5 years? Unemployed for 3 years? That's a danger signal. No one will want me. So there's a sense of being an unattractive sexual partner, an unattractive young man. It also means that there's no money to invest in opportunities for future employment, starting a small business, getting particular training for a particular job that seems to have promise. For young women, it's similar, but with a different twist. Young American women who are unemployed have an alternative, which is the sex trades or the softer sex trades. And what do I mean by that? I mean, there's a big surge in being sugar mamas to sugar daddies, which are men who support you while you go to school or support you while you live in your apartment because you're unemployyed and you don't have any money. There's a big increase in porn jobs. There's a big increase in stripping jobs. As well as, of course, prostitution. But it means that your value is your value as a sex object, which has profound effects. Most sex workers take drugs to obscure to themselves the humiliations that they face by being sex workers, because there's not much respect in the society for sex workers. That's what I wrote the article about. It's also the majority of people in higher education in the United States now are women. That's in college, in graduate school for master's and PhDs. And it means getting out of school and seeing that for all your struggle and for all your debt, there's nothing for you to do unless you want to go into a softer sex trade, even if it's just being a waitress in a strip club where you have to be quite sexy to get tips. So that takes the hopes and dreams and possibilities of young women and smashes them to the ground. For men from 30 on, it's often a body blow. A lot of men have been raised to think that part of their manhood is that they are providers and that they have a good job and they can make money. And when they lose their jobs, they often feel emasculated and furious. And a lot of men can't cope with their own loneliness and despair. They hide it under rage. And that's probably why unemployment is one of the huge factors for men who murder their families and men who go into their places of former employment and mow everybody down, or at least as many people as they can shoot. And it's in its most devastating manifestation, there's a big spike in domestic abuse of all kinds with unemployment, because men feel furious and they have no one they feel safe to vent it on but their families. And that's why battered wives increase. And in probably the most heartrending example, for every spike up in unemployment, there's a spike up in children admitted to emergency rooms with shaken baby syndrome, which means that it's usually a father who's stronger and can do this more forcefully, takes the baby and screams and shakes it until its brain turns to jelly and it becomes blind or retarded or dead. And that, you know, that could be prevented, of course. There's no help for the parents. And I had a client who came to me because when the child was born, he would say to his wife, I'm going to kill it. I'm going to kill it, not even calling it her or him. And she sent him to therapy because obviously her babysitting options with him were limited. And it turned out that that constantly crying baby was the voice inside himself that never let himself cry, that never let himself be vulnerable and sad. And once he understood that, he became a really compassionate caregiver. But a lot of men don't face those feelings in themselves because they're not macho.
Let me just interject before we shift and ask related questions. Because I'm the economist, so I want to make the economics point. Everything you just said means enormous cash costs. Costs of police that have to intervene in the growing tensions you've just described. Costs of mental health workers of all kinds, psychiatrists, counselors, who have to now intervene, often under emergency conditions. Costs in which families that are ripped apart by all of what you've described have to turn to their relatives, to friends, for the help financially to cope with the disintegration. In other words, here's my point as an economist. If you really counted with unemployment, not just the lost wages, not just the lost output, but all of the extra costs that the psychological damage unemployment does forces upon us as a community, you'd see that it would be infinitely cheaper for our economic system to keep people working, to give them a job, because that's less costly, no matter what they do, than what is happening to us. If we allow unemployment, the irrationality, economically speaking, is the consequence of the kinds of psychological effects you talk about. But let me push you a little bit. It's not just the unemployed that are affected psychologically by the experience of unemployment. I once was told by one of my students about how upset it made her to be sitting in an office over a period of 2 years watching more and more desks become empty as people around her were fired and the company didn't replace anybody. And this sense of dread and this sense of guilt, she felt that, well, I'm not the psychologist. You tell us, what are some of the psychological effects of unemployment for the people who aren't, in fact, unemployed, who still have a job, but have been surrounded by unemployment?
Well, what happens, I can tell you, in the case of a client of mine, he was the last one of 30 in the company for which he worked. And he finally quit. He couldn't stand feeling that as he was at his desk, there was a large knife suspended by a hair over his neck as he bent down over his desk. Because the terror was worse than the effect itself. And the studies indicate that those workers in an office or in a factory or anywhere, any other place of work, who have retained their jobs have a greater anxiety level than those who lost their jobs, who know where they stand, even if it's in the sub-basement. They know they're in the sub-basement rather than waiting to be thrown there at any moment. So it causes enormous anxiety and pain for those people who aren't yet fired. And it also causes a constant struggle because you see the atrophy around you. And then the boss says, well, actually, I don't have the money to give you quite as much. You're going to have to pay a greater amount of your health insurance, or you're not getting health insurance, or you're going to get a lower hourly rate, and your vacation is out. Your bargaining power, as one of the few survivors, is totally atrophied. So it's a terrible, terrible position to be in. And really, what we're talking about is an across-the-board decimation of people's hopes and possibilities, which trickle down to their children. And they also point to the costs of inequality in the society as people are more and more divided, with the top 1% doing ever better, while the bottom, I would say 80%, increasingly suffer. There's a book called The Spirit Level by Wilkinson and Pickett, which very meticulously documents every statistic to show the effects of inequality on societies.
Well, let me interrupt you and ask you to pursue that, because I was going anyway to say, in addition to the effects of unemployment that are psychological, what about what goes with unemployment? The fact that rich and poor become further and further divided, that the inequality that assaults us at every point, and that I tried to also put into the program in the first half today, how does that affect people psychologically? The very the inequality that unemployment intensifies.
Well, I think the first thing that happens, and this is with both inequality and also unemployment, is a sense of hopelessness, a sense of despair and giving up. And you can really see that in the last election. The majority didn't vote. And those people who didn't vote in particular were those most dispossessed. Single mothers, single women, Hispanics, African Americans, and
young people generally.
In fact, the hopelessness and despair that our system can ever help was reflected in the fact that 51% of young people don't even register, and only 13% of young people voted. Wow. 48% of Hispanics didn't bother to vote.
So your argument, if I can tease it out and make it blunt, is
they give
that
up.
Unemployment and inequality combine to produce a hopelessness, which is reflected, among other things, in a disinterest in civic affairs and no voting, and with all then the consequences to a society of that. And if that were counted by an economist, it would be even more overwhelming why unemployment should never be allowed as part of a community, since we know as a society that there's more work to be done in rebuilding our cities, rebuilding our schools, providing daycare for the millions who need it. We have lots of things that need to be done. We have people who want a job. We have the wealth to hire them to produce the things we need. And now you're telling us when we don't do that, when we let people be unemployed, the social costs are even bigger,
are staggering.
Then the irrationality of unemployment itself becomes really highlighted by what you're saying.
Totally highlighted. Because, you know, what you have is people feeling they're scammed. I wrote about that in Truth Out. Because you have 36.6% of people actually voting in the United States. You have $4 billion spent on the last election. And that's a small number of people who even cared enough to vote, and yet it's constantly hyped as this grand democratic involvement and this one and that one, the horse races of, you know, follow the race to see who wins, when most people not only aren't following, they're just turned off. They turned off the television set. They're not watching that race. Right. They're checked out. And inequality has a raft of consequences that were beautifully documented in the spirit level. There's a lack of trust because people feel they're scammed. The rich feel like, on some level, they know they have no right to be gathering the fruits of everyone else's labor and getting rich, right, and not being taxed for their stocks and bonds while all these others are being taxed. And so they decide that they are a superior breed, and that they deserve this, and these other people are highly suspect and should be treated as outcasts and semi-criminals.
Or if, like in the Metropolitan Opera, even if they're a skilled musician, well, if there's not enough money coming in,
they should pay the price. That's right.
The wealthy man who can't possibly spend what he's sitting on, Mr. Koch there, he has no responsibility here whatsoever.
Because the Metropolitan Opera is being very nice to David Koch because they think then maybe he'll give us a little, because they're all in the position of beggars.
Right.
While the power of those who are the donor, the noblesse who obliges to these begging pathetics, goes on. On the most basic level, Inequality means lower life expectancy. People don't live as long. The United States has the same life expectancy as Cuba, a very poor country. We have the most expensive healthcare system in the world, even though it doesn't deliver very quality healthcare. They have one of the least expensive, because most of it's in preventative care. And yet they have the same life expectancy. And in terms of infant mortality, Cuba is ahead of the United States. And they are one of the most equal countries in the world. Another cost of inequality is all sorts of addictions, alcohol, all sorts of drugs.
What's the link there?
Pills. The link is that if you don't feel you have a hope in the real world, all you can look forward to is getting high and being in a world that looks better and feels better to you. Because you don't feel you have a voice in the world outside of yourself. You don't feel you have a hope in the real world. You alter the look of the real world and you alter your experience of it so that it looks much better. And that's the link. Another one is something you wouldn't suspect, but that's obesity. Because for most people, food is the most available comfort. And as people are more despairing, they get heavier and heavier. In the poorest states, like West Virginia, has the highest obesity rate in the country, Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, the places of the greatest number of dispossessed people in the most unequal states in the Union have the highest rates of all of these terrible things and addictions and obesity among them. The educational performance of children declines, and that's because the schools are cut.
And again, I am, as an economist, overwhelmed. These are vast social costs. Our children are in trouble in the schools as a result of these events. Therefore, their productivity over their lifetimes is reduced. The cost of the addictions, a disruption of the family. Again, the overwhelming irrationality of not providing jobs for people, which is what we need and want. The irrationality of not doing it is something made wildly clear. But we're running out of time.
Okay, I
need to ask you one more.
Okay, I want to say one more thing here because it totally makes your point.
Please.
We are the homicide leader. We have 7 times more than any other of the developed countries in the world, and that's poor places like Poland or Croatia or whatever. And that's really expensive. It costs $100,000 a year approximately to keep someone in Rikers. It costs about $30,000. To support somebody and put him in a community college. So that you're really talking about crazy costs that go up with inequality of imprisonment and homicide.
Okay. Austerity, the way that our broken economic system is trying to cope with its own failure, the crisis, has led governments to cut back social programs. In a minute and a half, which is all we have for this interview, unfortunately, tell us something about the psychological effects of being a citizen in a country where the government is cutting back on the support, on the nurture, on the help it provides people.
Well, people are constantly frustrated and upset because they're waiting in long lines for things they deserved up front. They give up hope. They give up on the medical care because the clinic line is too great. They give up in terms of obesity and just indulge themselves. The cut programs in the schools and after-school programs means kids are alone. And the highest number of crimes against children and by children happen in the hours from when school is let out and there's no after-school program to when parents come home. It also means that the children become obese. 1 out of 10 children is enormously fat. And that's because they're no after-school programs, but they've been really decimated. All they can do is stay home. They have to stay in the house because it's dangerous, because they're not living in safe neighborhoods with supervised playgrounds. And so they stay in the house, play with their violent Game Boys, their violent video games, their computers, and they sit. Because it's dangerous to run around outside the way children should for their own development, as well as the government cuts the, quote, extras, which are things like athletics in the classroom, or music, which kids could practice at home, or dancing, or any of the other things that would have given kids a stake in life, no less their parents an expectation that their kids are being taken care of.
I wish we had more time. We always run out. If folks would like more, use the email, let me know, and we'll bring Dr. Farhad back. Thank you very much.
I want to say one more thing, okay, which is without a movement, there is no hope. And what people need is a basic place to go with their upset, as they are with smaller things like the $15 minimum wage and other such movements outside of the government structure.
So let me hear from you. And again, our two websites, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. Please use those websites. They're available to you 24/7. I want to thank truthout.org, that remarkable independent source of news and analysis every day. Make use of them as well. A final word. We are dependent on you for financial support, as are the radio and TV stations that bring you this program. Please help them when they ask for your support. The way to help us is really easy. Again, go to the two websites. They have donate buttons and explanations. They will allow you to provide whatever support you can afford and you might find useful. We will be back again next week with another program. And again, one more time, please send us your thoughts, your comments, your ideas of how to make the program better. If you're interested in having me come to your area to speak, let us know that. And if you can support us, know that we will be grateful, and it'll help make this program better yet than we have so far achieved. I look forward to talking with you again next week.
Thing gonna change.